Blog Talk Radio.
We are the movie geeks, Jamie and Jerry.
Yep, we are.
That's
here.
Right.
Welcome to our show.
Now, Jerry, you were away Wednesday night.
I know,
for a special show.
I was.
That you attended.
I was for a special show, but it sounds like I missed a really good show. You guys are talking about Mel Gibson.
I know. We spent an hour talking about Mel Gibson.
No,
yeah.
But it was fascinating. But also, I just want to say that the interview with Christian Clarion from the movie Farewell, that was fascinating. Because I didn't know a lot of that, and that was just a really good interview.
Thank you.
No, it was really good, because I liked Merry Christmas a lot. I saw that like 4 or 5 years ago, but it was just cool to actually hear him and have you in the way you engaged him and everything. That was really cool.
Well, I appreciate that, but let me get your take. You can limit it to a yes or no if you want, so we don't spend another hour talking about it. But the main topic of discussion is Mel Gibson over.
Yeah.
Okay.
let me just have a couple of minutes
yes.
to talk about this. I realized this, I think, last summer or the summer before on this show. Ironically, I had become like Mel Gibson's defender in some way, and that was never, not that I admire his work in the 80s, obviously, the stuff I grew up on, but I have a confession to make to you. I went to go see The Passion of Christ, and for the couple months leading up to that, I saw it the opening day on Ash Wednesday. I was very nervous about seeing that film. Very nervous, just of all the pre-hype and the way the film was made or whatever. And I stand by what I said to you, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, about Khalid Deschanel's cinematography. And I do still think, and when I walked out of the movie, that was the one thing. I came home and talked to my dad about the movie. And I said that was the thing that really stood out to me. I thought that visually the film looked really good.
That was what stood out to me about Apocalypto, too. I mean, he's never made a bad-looking directing-wise.
No, that's very true. That's a very good point about Apocalypto, too. Watching the movie The Passion of the Christ, though, being Jewish, you're like, wow, this movie's really stacked against me. and I'm not making that up. While watching it, I can make all the jokes I want, but in all seriousness, watching the movie, I'm like, wow, this is he really in there. There are some obviously I don't know how it really went down, but there's some parts in previous films like Ben-Hur or The King of Kings, which I had actually watched both of those before I went to go see this. They were on, Turner Classics had been showing them before that came out, and I'd watch those again. Wow, he really stacked the deck against us. That's all I could think of while watching. No, because there's that one scene.
The one scene where
they bring out Barabbas, and I almost shouted out. I'm like, that's not Anthony Quinn. What are you doing?
But listen. If it wasn't for the controversy preceding the opening of Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
And the revelation about his father being a Holocaust denier and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Would the movie have played anti-Jewish to you?
I don't know. That's an excellent question. And it's very important because you actually bring up a good point about the father, because it's that New York Times Magazine story that breaks a year before the movie comes out, that where all this starts. That's really where all this starts. And I could go back and say a year before that, where he announces the movie and he just goes ballistic against the Vatican.
Yeah. Well, there's something that switched in him around that time.
But all right, let's forget about the Passion of the Christ for now. You know, I think Chris said it best last week. You hit a woman, and that's bad enough. You hit a woman who's holding the baby. That's not, you know, forget it. It is also the use of the N-word, and there's supposedly more to this tape now. There's more audio.
He's clearly a racist, mm-hmm. and I don't think it was something said solely in anger, because I've been angry, honest to God. I mean, I would be honest and open about it. I've been angry before,
mm-hmm.
But I've never. It's never occurred to me to use use words like that,
yeah.
to use racial slurs like that. It just hasn't.
But, no, yeah. I think what's very interesting here, you know, a lot of people were yesterday when Ari Emanuel, I think it was yesterday or the day before, they decided to drop him from William Morris. He, you know, a lot of people, it took the N-word to say when he made all those anti-Semitic comments in 2006. A lot of people will remember he did write a thing on Huffington Post to everyone should shun Mel Gibson back then. But I think it took...
LaMotta, you mean? The one that just died?
No, Ari Emanuel.
Okay.
He had actually written something on Huffington Post 4 years ago when that whole thing with the sugar tits incident broke out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It's just, you know, if I'm going to pick a thing, it's a sugar tits.
Which is brilliant, by the way. It's the most brilliant thing he's done in the past few years.
Yeah.
That
it was, you know...
It's over now. It is over.
Yeah. And I wanted to say this, though. When you're an actor or a musician or whatever your talent is, whatever your art is, when your escapades eclipse that's never good.
Yeah.
When your escapades eclipse your art, that's never good. And that's what's happened here the last couple of years. And we both of us, you know, we thought Edge of Darkness was a decent, gritty thriller. But, you know.
And it didn't perform.
No, it didn't.
I mean, it performed less than $50 million at the box office. So
yeah, I mean, who would have thought that 10 years ago? You know, who would have?
Yeah, it wouldn't happen 10 years ago. And actually, watching the movie, it felt a little outdated. I mean, it felt like a movie that was made 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It's a very good point. I think actually, you know, you and Chris last week said it. He's made 2 7s in a row.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of like Night and Day feels like a 80s. Or early 90s film. It feels like his last action hero in a way.
It does feel like that, but he just jumped off on the sofa. He didn't, and the thing with Brooke Shields, but it's not like he insulted every race on the planet.
yeah, which I still don't kind of understand why people haven't forgiven Tom Cruise for that.
Yeah.
You know? And I don't feel like they have.
No, they haven't. Obviously, they haven't. Although I do think this motion Night and Day has found like this adult audience somewhere in the summer. It has found it. It's not as much as it would have maybe 4 years ago, but it has found it.
Yeah. Well, let's get a conversation started real quick, Dean, before we patch in your call, and then we'll play the interview a little bit later on the show. You see any movies the past week since you've been on the air with us?
Oh yeah, I've seen a couple. The first thing I want to talk about is the Girl Played with Fire,
uh-huh.
the second volume of the sequel to the girl with the dragon tattoo, and it's just, Jamie, it's incredible.
Really?
It's these movies are great, and as much as I love David Fincher, I don't know who they're going to get to play the girl.
Right.
She is so incredible in the Swedish films. My mom was telling me, who are they going to get? I mean, I know Carey Mulligan is lobbying very hard to play it, but I think since they are going to remake these films, that's a given. There's nothing we can do about that. I think they'd be best to go with an unknown.
Yeah.
But I love both these films, and I feel really bad because I tried to read the first book, and it's not so much I couldn't get into it. I kept coming back to it after days after reading it, and, you know, I lost, you know, I couldn't keep up with it. But as far as movies go, they're incredible.
I've heard of some people that like the books, but critically, across the board, essentially, they're scratching their heads thinking, why are these books popular? Because they say that they're boring, slowly paced books. It's like reading that first book. One critic I saw an interview on, Charlie Rose, he said, "I just there's too much about the inner workings of Swedish tax law to be very entertaining
for
me."
That's true. That kind of reminds me of Elvis Mitchell's review of episode one, The Phantom Menace, where he said, "Will kids really care about the taxation of trade routes?"
Right.
There's some truth to that. But the movies are fascinating. I really.
So this one is not, from what I've read of it, they said it was kind of middling.
It seems like the people who liked the first movie, which is everyone, there are people who aren't crazy about the second one, because it's, I guess it's much more action-oriented.
Right.
It's not as, if you want to use it, cerebral as the first one. But it's still a good, it's a good movie, though. I really enjoyed it. I can't say I was never bored like that.
Okay. Well, I've seen two completely different movies.
I want to hear about
in the past 24 hours. And the first one, you'll be shocked at the fact that I had never seen it before.
That's okay.
I was over at my good friend Rick's last night and pulled out a movie that I had not yet seen, that he's crazy about, that you're crazy about.
Oh shit.
And
that, what is
and that? That's Donnie Darko.
Oh, you've never. Oh, okay. What did you think?
I liked it a lot.
Stock is going so up in the last 2 seconds, you have no idea.
Well, hang on. I like it a lot. I think the use of music's great. The atmosphere's great. The mood of it gets under your skin. The performances. I'm mystified by some of it. Which I think is an appropriate response.
That is, you've only seen it one time, so yeah.
But I think most of it I can figure out. I just can't figure out why the mother's on the plane.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's the one piece that makes me scratch my head. But any movie that makes you think, there's either something to it or there's nothing to it.
Right.
I don't know. I don't really know. It's like sometimes you watch a Lynch movie and you're thinking, maybe he's just being weird or there's something to this.
Okay, well, you brought up Lynch, and now we're here full circle with my box review and Southland Tales review and all that stuff over the last 3 years. Do you see Lynch in Donnie Darko?
Maybe a little.
Okay.
I mean, any time a movie's even slightly cryptic, everyone brings up Lynch.
Well, I realize that, but you are an expert on Lynch, so I think that no, you are. I mean,
at first I thought this movie is building itself up to be just a kid with emotional problems who's possibly schizophrenic and burns down,
well,
the school and has a violent kind of, and then it morphed into something entirely kind of different.
No, but that's a very good thing to bring up, because what we forget about Donnie Darko is at its heart, it's a movie about teenagers. It's like almost like a Dark Side of John Hughes, if you will, like a really twisted take on a John Hughes movie. So that's a very good point that you bring up. But I was just asking, because you seem to be since I've been doing this show and everything, you are the foremost authority on Lynch of us. So do you see any of that in Donnie Darko?
A little bit. Just obviously in the surreal quality of it, and in the cryptic kind of telling of it.
Right.
But Lynch is so specific. There are very few artists that can get that level of mood and atmosphere. And I do think there's some consideration of the audience in the direction of Donnie Darko.
Right.
And I don't feel like that with Lynch all the time. That he gives a damn with the audience.
No, that's true. Donnie Darko is one of those films I watched late when it came out on videotape. I watched it. And then when it was done, I was like, wow, I got to watch this again. I watched it, the whole thing again, right afterwards. And it's one of those kind of films. It's a head trip.
I love the use of pop music. I love the visual style of it. And hearing about Southland Tales and watching The Box, I think he's a certain kind of absurdist filmmaker.
That's a good word, yeah.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see how what else he produces, what kind of career he has over the long haul.
Well, that's the thing, Jamie.
If he's allowed to.
I don't know. I don't know if there's anything after the box. I just don't know. That's the magic thing there. Allowed to, and obviously, you know, I'm gonna go down with the ship there with the box review, and the Southland Tales. But no, that's a very good observation. I think that's really good that you finally watched it. I think it's good. I think a lot of people would like to hear that, what you have to say about it. You know?
And actually, I've got all the Harry Potters here, too, because I've only seen the first Harry Potter, so I'm going to catch up with 2 through 5 or something.
Yeah, I think...
2 through 6.
Yeah,
no, 7 and 8?
We're at 6, and of course 7 is broken into 2 parts, as is Breaking Dawn, the Eclipse movies that are broken into 2 parts.
Well, there's not a chance in hell I'm going to catch up with those.
I realize that, Jamie. I realize that there's not a chance in hell that you're going to give...
I'm only going to go so far with this, you know. And then I watched a movie today that's totally different from Donnie Darko, and I feel... I don't know whether to feel ashamed admitting that I enjoyed it as much as I did.
All right, tell us.
17 again.
Okay. You
not the George, not the George Burns thing. The
no,
Zac
I know,
Efron
I know
thing.
Exactly what it is, and I'm gonna. If you want me to go first, or do you want to go first?
Well, yeah, you can go first, and I'll
okay,
respond.
What I'm about to say, well. If the review of the box didn't condemn me, this will definitely condemn me. 17 again is like a fantastical version of Sunshine Cleaning, in one way. I actually explained this to a couple of friends of mine, but you know you get to relive and try to correct these things. Whereas Sunshine Cleaning, the Amy Adams character really can't really go back. She's just sort of trying to deal with the wreckage of her life. I found it ironic that both of these films came out the same day. Now, let me ask you this, Jamie. Did you like 17 again?
I genuinely enjoyed it. And, you know,
the
main reason why I enjoyed it surprised me, because I don't watch the High School Musical or
no,
all that stuff.
No, of course not, yeah.
And I hear about me and Orson Welles and that Zac Efron's stretching out. I thoroughly enjoyed Zac Efron in it. I thought he was really good.
It looked like he was having a good time, too. I mean... He enjoyed the premise and ran with it. So yeah,
he's got chops, you know. And and it's one of those movies that obviously there was a trend and for a few years where all you'd see were these body switching movies, and this isn't quite like that. And I like the fact that when he goes back, it's to help his kids and their adolescent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
family.
That I thought was a good touch.
And I think there's some good comedy in it.
Yeah.
So I like 17 again.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I enjoyed it too. It's amazing that you watch this movie and that you watch Hot Tub Time Machine, and it is amazing the influence of Back to the Future.
And they reference it in Donnie Darko, actually.
Yeah. I mean, you can't help but reference it. It's such an influential movie. I mean.
Yeah, so but that movie, unlike Donnie Darko, did not mystify me.
No, of course not.
Pretty straightforward.
No, of course I'm gonna go down with the ship. I'm gonna be Richard Kelly's like diehard fan for the rest of his days.
Well, that's good. He needs one.
I don't think I'm the only one, but
Richard Kelly fan club party of one.
Yeah, it is party of one.
I'm sure there are other...
there are a lot of others, actually, yeah. But I think that club has diminished since 2001 or 2002.
Well, if he made his big studio movie with The Box, which isn't a big studio movie, but it was a studio-commissioned film, you can't say that he was selling out with it.
No, it's
still an original vision. You know?
Right, it is. It is very much an original vision. It's just the thing is, I think a lot of people thought The Box would be the film that would carry him into the next film, and I don't think there is a next film right now.
Yeah. You seen the new trailer for Machete?
Yeah.
It's interesting. It looks like they're trying to sell it as a mainstream badass action movie in the
mm-hmm.
second trailer. And the first trailer, it came across the campy nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
They've kind of subverted that here
right.
in the second trailer. I have hopes for it.
Oh, I have a lot of hopes for it. I think the thing is, it's very interesting what started out. I mean, am I wrong to think what started out as a joke really is become a like the full-fledged hope of Troublemaker Studios in one sense?
Yeah.
I like Predators. I saw Predators.
Right.
And I like that. I actually think what's very interesting about Predators is he was able to bring it in. I didn't realize this. For $38 million, I had no idea.
Yeah.
I had no idea that this was even a consideration. But he brought it in, and
all Predator movies make at least $75 million domestically. Even something like Alien versus Predator.
Oh, those movies are awful, though. This brings it back to what I like about his film, or not his film, it's the guy who directed the Control and then Vacancy.
Right.
Is that...
I think somebody just picked up your line.
I think someone picked up my line. I don't know who it is, but please get off the phone. Thank you.
They're off.
Okay, thank you. He always wants to go back to basics. I mean, because they want to do this with a couple of films, a couple of franchises. And
yeah.
With
I'm
the
here.
Predator film, this new one. I mean, it's not a great film, but it's a fun film. It's a B movie. I mean, if there was a B movie, this is the one. And he takes it back to basics. They go back to what the first film was about because they reference the Arnold Schwarzenegger film in this one. Which is,
oh, do they really?
Oh, yeah, they do. So, thankfully, like it's like Alien versus Predators 1 and 2 never happened. I don't even think the Danny Glover one happened, for that matter, the way they're talking. But it's a good film. You're not expecting a lot from it. And I know that's a horrible thing to say about a movie, but you're really not. And it's good. I mean, Adrian Brody, what is the actress's name? Who's in it? Is it Alexa Braga?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just saying yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Jamie, I really appreciate that. Who else is in it? Topher Grace is in it. And this is the I'm watching, I'm like, this is a guy from that 70s show, an Indian company in the ocean, that Ocean's 12 movie. Yeah. But
yeah, it's an odd cast for an action flick.
It's very odd, but I forgot about it. Lawrence Fishburne shows up in the middle of the movie.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just like, oh, yeah, he's in it too, isn't he? I'm just like, oh, Mr. Fishburne, it's so good to see you. You look so different from Thurgood Marshall in your...
Well, you know, it did decently.
It finished third
place.
It did. It did better than they thought it would do. And... It's an interesting idea that you would reverse it. So you take the humans, which they don't really explain how all of them are transported to this game reserve planet, but they're there, and you have the predators are the ones hunting them.
Right.
It's good. I mean, like I said, it's better than either the Alien versus Predator movies. It kind of makes you nostalgic for the first one though.
Yeah, I mean, the first one's pretty darn good.
Yeah, I mean, that's like at the time it came out, the whole thing was, because everyone was so used to Arnold being the Terminator, it was like, oh, he's going to be the one that's haunted this time.
Dylan! Dylan!
Arnold!
They got you pushing too many pencils. Dylan! Get to the chopper! It's great. Yeah, McTiernan, man, he made some great... flicks.
Yeah, he did. He did.
Who knows what he's making in prison? I don't know.
Oh, God, that's right. Oh, God. Oh, man.
It's so odd. It's odd.
It is.
Wiretapping. I didn't understand the whole thing. I mean,
I don't either, so.
But, man, and the Thomas Crown affair, it's so great.
Mm-hmm.
Die Hard. What's your favorite? See, I've been rewatching a lot of older Siskel and Ebert things,
mm-hmm.
reviews on YouTube. And I remember, like, one, if not the favorite movie of Gene Siskel that year was Die Hard 2, which surprised me. I'm not really into Die Hard 2, and I tried to rewatch it again last week.
No, it's a good film, but that year, I mean, if you go by Siskel and Ebert, remember the film that they liked that no one else liked is The Godfather Part 3?
Yes.
Remember the review? They said, it's just so good to see these characters again.
I did rewatch that, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great, and I was talking about this with some friends the other day, you're never going to be able to recapture the magic of 1 and 2, but Part 3 is pretty damn good. I mean, it really is, but I just never forget the review. Like, it's just so good to be with these characters again. Like, it's like a wedding or something.
Yeah, like it's such a pleasant family reunion.
Yeah,
I think their review was okay on Godfather 3. There's some that they were really off. I think they're really off base with like Empire of the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
They're really off base, which neither one of them really liked. They're really off base with Poltergeist, which neither one of them liked.
Mm-hmm.
But Die Hard 2, I just, Siskel, just rabid about Die Hard 2, and it was just super shocking to me. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it.
No, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just surprising that, that was a weird summer, because that was a summer where, you had every week there's a new number one movie. There was the only movie, like, I think we've talked about this before, but Ghost was what turned out to be the movie of the summer. But
yeah,
there was always a new number one movie every week.
Yeah, I just, of course I have loyalties to the first Die Hard, but I'm one that's always liked the third one.
Oh, the third one's great. Samuel Jackson and Jeremy Irons. I mean, that's a great film.
It's kind of nonstop, and how beaten can that guy get, Bruce Willis?
Yeah.
I mean, he's just like a shredded bloody pulp by the end of that movie. I've had to restart my computer because it froze, and I'd really like to play this interview.
Yeah, no, so I'd like to hear this interview. Huh?
We have to give it a few minutes to come back up.
Yeah, that's cool. What do you think about the box office numbers this week?
Despicable Me in first place was $60 million, followed by Eclipse. I guess that's okay.
I don't have a problem with that. Eclipse is actually didn't fall as much as they thought. Like New Moon, I think fell like 60-70%, and this only fell 50%. So that means it has some staying power.
I might have thought Despicable Me would have done a little better.
It did better than I thought it would do, though. I mean, I didn't think with Toy Story 3, I was really surprised that. But I guess, you know, you got to take the kids to see something and whatever the new thing is.
I hear it's good. I hear they have a Barry Manilow tribute in it.
Oh, really?
In Despicable Me. Yeah, they got a...
Why aren't you there right now? I mean,
Copacabana skit or something.
Oh, why aren't you there right now to watch it? I mean, you know... No, but going... I am surprised, and I have no interest in watching The Last Airbender. I really just don't. But that's actually done better than I thought it would do.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't spoken to anyone that's actually seen it, though. Among those non-critics.
Right, right, right.
So I don't know what the audience meter is. I know what the tomato meter is with the critics, but...
Right.
Which is just abysmal.
Yeah, well, did Armand White like it, or...?
He didn't review it, conspicuously, but he did review this new book, The Men Who Would Be King, about DreamWorks, about Spielberg and Katzenberg, and Geffen. And the failed DreamWorks endeavor, and Armand reviewed that for the New York Times, kind of a savage review, and which got a response on the husband of the author's blog, that kind of criticized Armand White, but then in the end that said anyone that favors Jonah Hex over Toy Story 3, I guess it's a badge of honor that he's panned our book. But apparently, and it was a really well-written review from Armand, I haven't read the book, but it said that it focuses so much more on financial failure and cutthroat business ethics and that kind of thing, and a lot less on the creative risks and output from them during their short reign.
Right.
DreamWorks, you know. So I guess it's a particular book that, you know.
Right.
Which, if you think about it, I mean, one of Spielberg's big movies under DreamWorks was Amistad, which is not a completely successful movie, but it is a brave project, too.
Yeah, but isn't it all Saving Private Ryan under?
Yeah, well, that was that was co-production.
Right.
Between, I think, I forget who else came out with that, maybe.
Mm.
Maybe Paramount. I'm not sure if you're Universal or something.
Right.
But Amistad is, they refer to it as something like Schindler's List 2 in the book.
Right. Oh, God, okay.
Meanwhile, I didn't realize,
when did Arbon Wright review, was this in this week's or last week's book review? Or?
I think it's in this week here.
Oh, okay, I'll have to look for that, okay. Wow.
Meanwhile, you know who's bidding on Miramax?
Who?
Rob Lowe.
Rob Lowe has that much money?
Apparently he's gotten together with some investment people, and they're making a go at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
So, you know, somebody will own Mr. Wonderful. I don't know.
Oh, my God. Okay. But
I mean, there's a legacy of great movies that they have, obviously.
Oh, dude, there's an enormous legacy. It's not just them, but, you know, they keep talking about, you know, MGM, and now they're saying that Summit, was it Summit and Spyglass are going to run it?
Really?
Yeah, that's what I heard last week, but you know, the death knell about James Bond is short-lived because Sam Mendes and Daniel Craig said they still want to do it, but then all of a sudden Christopher Nolan says, I'd love to do a Bond film.
Yes, yeah.
And as much as I'd love to see Daniel Craig and Sam Mendes' Bond film, the idea of Christopher Nolan doing a Bond film is, wow, out of this world.
That's pretty promising. Yeah, that makes you kind of salivate, the thought
mm-hmm.
of that. I think he'd be great, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But Inception, that's Friday. That's this
mm-hmm.
coming Friday.
Right.
Which will be a real interesting how well that does.
Oh, I think it will do well next weekend. I think I'm curious. I just want to see it. But, I mean, everyone who has seen it so far says it's a movie that requires several viewings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
which hopefully people like it enough on that first viewing to go back
exactly.
and watch. That's what,
yeah.
that's what they're betting on.
Yeah, you go back to see it again.
Yeah. Leo's been doing really well lately.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it hasn't come back up yet.
Okay, it hasn't come back up yet. Okay, no, Leo has been doing well. Shutter Island, I can't complain with his performance in Shutter Island. I can't complain with really any of his performances since, you know. Look, the only performance I'm not crazy about is The Beach, and not even so much the performance. This is a movie, I love the book so much that no movie could do it justice.
That was his follow-up to Titanic, right?
Yeah. Well, or wasn't The Man with the Iron Mask?
I don't know. I don't know. And then Celebrity's in there, too.
Yes,
his little cameo
is
in that.
There, yes.
Because Woody Allen said, look, I had the first movie Leo came out with after Titanic, and it still tanked.
But, you know, this is going to be interesting because I think that Leo is definitely, and our friend Roland, who would agree with this, he thinks that Damon and DiCaprio are really the two actors to watch the next decade. He really thinks they're the best of the best. Now, having said that, Matt Damon's new film, The Adjustment Bureau, has been pushed back to next year.
Huh.
With Emily Blunt, and I was really looking forward to that. And once again, a film that I was looking forward to has been pushed back to next year.
Well, are they re-releasing Shutter Island at the end of this year? I thought they were for
no, they
Academy.
Aren't. Avatar they're re-releasing though.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, now,
eight,
now what is
eight additional minutes of footage? But I don't think the Na'vi sex scene is in that 8 minutes.
God damn it. Why do these people want to do this to me? I mean...
And if it is, I would hope it would be longer than 8 minutes. But who knows? But, yeah. And then Titanic 2012.
Oh, is that for... That's going to really happen?
Unconfirmed, but they're shooting for April 2012.
Wow.
So they're taking time with the conversion. And I doubt they do it unless they could do it right.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of James Cameron, the thing that came out last week was he made $350 million from Avatar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's great work if you can get it. I mean, I didn't know what I was supposed to react. I was like, $350 million. I could use that, yeah. I mean
he deserves it.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone, you know, deserves $350 million, it's, I think he didn't, did not get paid for that film to cut costs or something. I know he did that on Titanic.
Right.
And they made good to him.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that, but, you know, if anyone has made, there's no one really that's made more money for the studio than James Cameron, so.
True. Very yeah. True.
He should be the major benefactor of that wealth.
True.
Yeah. And then, I don't know what else I was going to say. It's still trying to pull it up. My computer's so slow.
That's all right. Yeah, well, that's a lot of money, though, man. I mean, that's a lot of money. A lot of great money.
We're just trying to kill time here until we get
yeah,
this
folks, we're
we
trying
get this
to kill
interview.
Time. We don't really have a lot to say.
Could do some movie trivia if you'd like.
No, but is there anything else that's happened in the last week that you want to talk about?
Nothing that really strikes me. They chose David Fincher's Social Network to open up the New York Film Festival, and they came out with another trailer for it. And somebody posted something I saw that said, why would I care about a Facebook movie? And so I posted David Fincher in response.
Right.
That's essentially all you need to know.
No, I mean, it's going to be a fascinating movie.
And Aaron Sorkin writing it.
Yeah, I mean... There's a
yeah.
lot of great stuff there.
And Andrew Garfield is one of the three leads in it. It was just
of
chosen
course.
As the new Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Does it matter who plays Spider-Man, really? It's Spider-Man people want to see. They don't give a crap who's in the suit, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There's like Jamie Bell and Josh Hutcherson, but once, you know, it was Andrew Garfield that was... I don't know who Andrew Garfield is, but...
Red Riding Trilogy, man.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, having said that, but, I mean, obviously the people watching Spider-Man don't really know the Red Riding Trilogy, but here's the thing. I mean, like you say, it really doesn't matter at this point. I don't know. I think it was a mistake to reboot it so soon. I really
yeah.
do. And I think the sad thing is, and I was talking to Paul Bassetti earlier about this, and he said, you know, you like Mark Webb. A lot of he did 500 Days of Summer, but he's going to get crucified for this. If this movie doesn't do well, it's on him.
Yeah.
And that's a sad thing, and he's right. I mean, you know, so I don't know.
From the director of 500 Days of Summer.
Yeah, I don't know where they got. And this whole thing, yeah, Mark Webb. Oh, it's because he can focus on the high school kids. Well, 500 Days of Summer was really about people in their late 20s, but okay, whatever.
Maybe it was just his last name. Like,
yeah, I know. I think it really was. His last name is Webb.
Can't wait for the Superman reboot. Hailed by James Ivory. From the director of Surviving Picasso.
Oh man!
Actually, the rumor is that they're giving the Superman reboot to Chris Columbus.
Really?
Yeah, Nolan's treatment they're giving to Chris Columbus.
Well, I mean, if it's based on his treatment, we know that Chris Columbus will follow every word of it. So
I don't know if it's a treatment or a script. I think Nolan's brother is writing the script for the next Batman,
mm-hmm.
and then they're working out a treatment for a story for the Superman reboot
mm-hmm.
together. I think that's how it's going down. But.
Oh, wow.
I think Chris Columbus did the first two Harry Potters. Those were the last two big studio movies he did.
He did Percy Jackson, though, too. So.
Chris Columbus did that, really?
Yeah, he did that. And didn't he do...
doesn't that sound like a movie, Percy Jackson? Doesn't that sound like a movie about the lead of a 50s doo-wop group instead of...
It does.
Of like...
It really does. But he also did... Didn't he do I Love You, Beth Cooper as well?
Yeah, yeah. I know he did that, yeah.
Okay, so, yeah. Wow, they're going to give him... All right, well, let him do it.
There was a time, though, when Chris Columbus... I don't know. I always looked at it as there was Spielberg, and then there was Zemeckis, who was unfairly or fairly regarded as Spielberg light. And then there's Chris Columbus, who fairly or unfairly is looked upon as Zemeckis light. So like,
well, yeah, there's some truth to that. Wow.
They're car recovery. So who is Chris Columbus light?
Oh, God. That's really...
I have no idea.
I have no idea either.
Are you near a computer?
Yes, I am.
Okay. If I can't get that, because I have my introduction and everything on this computer. So I'm trying to get it. I'm trying to get it open. It might be opening now. I can't even play my holding music, because my girl from Ipanema, because I don't have my switchboard out. Actually, okay. Still trying to open. So we have. I've been thinking about what the next director series should be.
Mm-hmm.
Where we pay tribute to a director.
Michael Cimino.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, okay.
Okay.
All right.
We talked about that the other day with we were talking Michael Cimino or Terrence Malick, one of the two, but.
Well, that's something, too. And plus, it'd be a short show, because there's very few films to talk about. That'd be good. That would be our first 20-minute show.
Yeah, I know.
What about Cronenberg?
I'm all for that. Definitely all for that. Is there anyone else that you had in mind? Cronenberg's a definite plus.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll keep thinking, but Cronenberg
okay.
came to mind. Terrence Malick, he says Tree of Life is his best film since Badlands.
How am I supposed to really put that in perspective?
And Criterion is releasing The Thin Red Line on...
I will get that. I will definitely buy that.
Yeah. And I guess Broadcast News, but...
Where did you hear about... Is that official?
No, it's not official. I think they've dropped hints about it or something.
Okay.
And here's... I don't think I've mentioned this on the show. I might have. But they also came out with a Blu-ray of Crumb.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are. Aren't they going to... Is it actually out, or...?
Yeah, it's coming out in the next month, I guess. But,
right, okay.
Which is a 16mm documentary that... You know, is known for its fascinating subject more than its distinctive look.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really like something you rush out to get on Blu-ray?
It's not about
Isn't like getting Plan 9 from Outer Space on Blu-ray
well,
so it can
it's a
bring up?
It's depressing as all hell. I remember going to see that with my friend Dave Hardiman. It's 15 years ago, but God, I'm old. I keep seeing that on all these podcasts the last couple of weeks, but I mean, I'm old. But it's a fascinating film. I would definitely buy it, but I have a Blu-ray. I buy it on Blu-ray, but it's so depressing, though.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not even talking about content. I'm talking about, you know, does that bring out the... Maybe that shouldn't be the reasoning when you choose what comes out on Blu-ray. You know,
it's so depressing. I feel like
the aesthetic qualities of a movie, maybe that isn't their criteria for releasing in Blu-ray.
Yeah, but as I feel like the kids from Despicable Me, it's so fluffy. It's just so depressing. But oh God, yeah. I don't know. Crumb is a very hard film to sit through. But it's a very well done film. But I don't know if it's something I'd go back and watch again though.
Yeah, I do remember really liking it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Lynch production. What I've never seen is that that documentary about the sadomasochistic couple, and one of them has cystic fibrosis.
Wait, which one is this?
I can't remember what it's called. It's a really famous documentarian, and it's,
I know what you're talking about, but what's the subject matter? Holy.
And it's like he's on his deathbed, and she continues to inflict pain on him, and it's like a testament of their love, their connection to one another.
Man, I mean.
I can't remember what it's called, but I remember reading the Ebert review of it.
Wow.
Yeah. One movie that I won't go see is, I won't watch is The Human Centipede, though. I won't put myself through that. But
you know, it's still on demand. I would like to see it. I'm just not in the mood to see it. How's that for...
You would like to see The Human Centipede?
I would like to see it, but I'm not dying to see it.
Yeah, I'm not really into it. Okay, hang on. I think there's hope here.
Okay.
It's coming back up. Problem loading page. Wow. This is great radio, let me tell you. All right. I was going to play some movie trivia tonight, actually.
All right, well, let's play it.
Here's some questions for you. Here's a category for you, Jerry.
Oh, God. Okay, yeah, let's do it.
Commercial voiceovers.
Okay.
All right. Who's the voice of Lowe's?
Oh, shit, I don't know. Who is
Lowe's,
it?
Lowe's, Let's Build Something Together.
No, I know, I realize that, but I honestly don't know, and I'm not going to...
Gene Hackman.
Really? He does Lowe's?
Yes.
Oh, man, good for him.
Who's the voice of AT&T? More bars and more places.
Robert Duvall? I
no.
wish...
He would be the voice of, like, the Bass Pro Shop or something. AT&T is Stanley Tucci.
Oh, okay, cool.
Okay.
Good for him.
Who is the voice of MasterCard?
Isn't that Hackman?
No. For everything else, there's MasterCard. And the $12 and then Priceless and, you know, the whole
thing. Oh, I don't know that. I'm not even going to try to pretend I know. I really don't.
Billy Cudrup.
Really?
Yep.
That explains why there's no sequel to Jesus, Son, or Waking the Dead. Shit, okay.
Waking the Dead, that's a good film.
That's a very good film. I love that film.
Okay, give me a moment. Man. This is great radio. My computer, I need a better computer. I promise in the next 2 minutes this interview is going to start. And I promise on replay, these pauses will be edited out. All right. So are you going to go see Inception Friday when it opens?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Is there a midnight screening of that? Like
I might go to the midnight, but I'll definitely go see it Friday. I'm really looking forward to that.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to The Kids Are All Right as well.
That is, like, massively raved about,
mm-hmm.
that movie.
Yeah.
You get A grades across the board from
mm-hmm.
everyone except Armin, so.
Well, that means it must be very good.
Yeah, I saw Charlie Rose's conversation with the makers of that, so.
Mm-hmm. She's a great director, Lisa Chulodenko, Laurel Canyon, High Art. She's really just a phenomenal director.
Yeah, they all were really into her because of High Art, and actually Ruffalo and Julia Moore both approached her, wanting to work with her before the script
mm-hmm.
ever materialized for The Kids Are All Right.
Right.
And this is a big Sundance movie from earlier this year. It's a couple that came out from this year, so that we're finally getting around to watching now. Another
right.
one is Welcome to the Rileys is coming out soon.
I'm curious about that too. But well, I think if the kids are all right, definitely has my name all over it.
Have you
I know
seen
it does. I just like I, it's just everything about it because a lot of people know I love Laurel Canyon. I like the high art, but I really love Laurel Canyon. And I just really love this filmmaker a lot, and it's a very interesting premise.
Dean, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I've been sitting here, like, listening through the pauses and everything.
I'm sorry, man.
Dean. I hope that you can forgive me in
this
years to come.
This was the worst show to call in early on.
Yeah, really. What do you think, man? I mean...
It was hilarious, but well, I'm glad I'm with you now. So.
Me too. What do you want to talk
yeah.
about, Dean, before we start this interview?
All right. Well, first of all, Mel Gibson's career is just about over, but maybe not quite because people have very short memories, as you know. So. So maybe not quite yet, and maybe not as a director. So
I think as an actor, though, yeah, I think that
as
may
an
be...
actor, though, as an actor, though, let's face it, we live in a time where there are no actors on screen that are successful. Very few, very, very, very few that are over 50 years old. I mean, I challenge you to name. Actors who are successful who are over 50 years old. And, okay.
But that's about the only one I can think of. Him and Morgan.
All right,
Freeman.
That's it.
Morgan
that's
Freeman,
it.
I think. Yeah, but otherwise.
Yeah, but he kind of started after his 50s. So
yeah, okay, you got me there. You got
me. He's kind of a character actor. I'm talking about non-character actors. There are not very many of them, especially people who used to be marquee names.
Okay. I'd like to ask both of you a question, actually. I'd actually like to ask both of you, because Dean, you, like Jamie, are very in touch with old Hollywood. What do you think actors like Robert Mitchum and Burt Lancaster, all the great, like, hard-boiled actors, would make of, like, you know, it's very interesting, we have all these actors lately.
I know what you're asking already.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Are you reading my emails?
You're asking...
my dreams? Did you steal my dreams like an Inception?
Yeah, I've been invading your dreams.
Okay,
no,
thank you, Dean, so much. Thank you, Dean. Okay, no, but, you know, there seems to be what's lost on a lot, seems like, in the last 10 years, is actors, the physical appearance, like they go train for a role.
Okay, so, let me put it right out for you, okay, because I've thought about this a lot.
Okay.
Okay, so you, starting with Tom Cruise mainly, you started getting a new kind of idea involved with casting. With these young, very boyish faces with no facial hair, okay?
Right.
They have no facial hair. Okay, let me just put it to you right here, okay? Look, Lee Marvin, he fucking killed people in World War II, all right?
Yeah.
We don't have anybody who killed anybody in real life.
Well, not in World War II. But, yeah.
We don't have anybody who's killed anybody in real life. Vietnam, Korea, Desert Storm, whatever. There is nobody who has killed anybody. Actually stabbed someone with a bayonet. Actually stabbed someone with a bayonet in their gut.
You're right, Dean. That is sorely lacking in movies. We've got from Lee Marvin to Zac Efron.
That's exactly right. What we've gone from is Lee Marvin and Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas and James Stewart, who was the highest ranking movie star in the military, by the way, even though he's like the everyman kind of guy. He was a brigadier general in the military, and I'll tell you, there's nobody in movies today. Everybody in movies today, all those guys in movies today are all from, like, Teen Beat.
True.
Right.
They're all from Teen Beat. They could never kill anybody no matter what. So
mm-hmm.
you don't have anybody who has any kind of real guts. You don't have any real men in movies anymore.
And a real man is one that can kill another man.
So are you saying it's
Stallone
and the
Expendables? I'm sorry, but you had those guys. I mean, those guys were real, and you knew it. And you knew that they were real men. Bogart, he didn't kill any men. Stewart, he never really killed any men. He was a flyer, you know, so he didn't actually stab anybody, but he probably dropped some bombs on some people. But you never have, you don't have anybody who's been in any. All they have really ever done is wanted to be in movies. They have never really done anything else.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you accidentally kill them with your car, does that count? I mean, would that be?
No.
Oh, dear.
Just trying to decipher Dean's definition of a real man.
No, so am I. I mean, I'm glad that Dean was on the same wavelength as me there.
there are no real men in movies anymore. There's plenty of real women. But they don't have any real roles to play because they're not playing opposite any real men.
Mm.
This is why movies are crappy. Movies are crappy now because movies are based on characters. Characters are based on the actors that play them.
Well, what about directors? I mean, someone like John Huston comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you have some people that kind of recall, like you have Oliver Stone. He killed some men in war and everything. And you know, you have some directors that are very tough. I mean, even Ridley Scott, who was never in war, as far as I know, you know, I would consider that kind of director or whatever, even though he's not doing anything incredibly great these days. But you know, there are some directors, because when you're a director, you have to be somewhat of a dictator. If you're a really great director,
mm-hmm.
you have to be somewhat of a dictator. And if you're somewhat of a dictator, you're already in a sort of war-minded mode, you know? So, you know, it's like, for directors, it's different. But definitely, most directors now, I mean, you're like trying to figure out who's the second rate Columbus. You couldn't even.
All right, you're breaking up. You're breaking up in more ways than one. I think the way this conversation is going.
I'm like walking back into a thing. So I'm
into another dimension that does not have good reception.
I have to tell you that AT&T is the worst. I'm going to sue AT&T.
No, I think I have the iPhone, Dean, and it's atrocious. The reception, everything is just awful.
Sue Stanley Tucci.
Yeah.
AT&T is the worst. I think everybody out there should sue AT&T because it's like class action suit because what they're doing is they're breaking down all their towers and they're making you buy like a little personal tower to like
mm-hmm.
to you know, so it's like fuck that, man. I'm like it's ridiculous.
Well, I appreciate you calling in the Cellular Phones United.
Always love when you call in.
Well,
thanks.
Wait, I want to talk about one more thing.
All right, no, let him talk about one more thing.
All right.
What's got plenty of time for the interview and everything.
Yeah. Like, what's people have been sent through
like blank spaces for like an hour now.
This is all going to be edited out anyway.
I know.
Well, go ahead.
I love that you just like dictated show protocol to us. Oh, I have plenty of time.
I'm telling you. Well, okay, so I don't know how long and I'm looking forward to the Sid and Nancy interview. But
oh, yes.
Anyway,
oh, my.
But, okay, so another thing. Okay, Donnie Darko.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
Wow, Donnie Darko is one of the greatest movies of the last decade.
I love you, Dean. Dean, you have cemented your reputation in my book. Thank you.
It's probably about number 15 on my list as far as I can remember right now. But,
holy shit.
I will tell you, number 15 on the best of the decade list. I will tell you that I had a very interesting run-in with Richard Kelly one time. At a screening of Donnie Darko back in 2002, which was only a year after it had come out.
Yeah,
And it had been a big success, and they brought it back to a theater that that I was living nearby in Atlanta at the time.
Right.
And at the time, I had just watched it, and when I first watched it, there was something about it that made me burst out into tears the moment I watched it.
Right.
And I didn't really know what it was. And I watched it a second time, and I still burst out into tears. And then I watched it a third time, and I realized that this was a movie. Okay, primarily this is before we talk about what the movie is really about. The movie is a tribute to 80s movies.
It is. You're right.
And when I was at a screening of Donnie Darko with Richard Kelly in attendance, I was very brave because at the time I was a film festival programmer. And my film festival was about to start, and I thought I was all full of myself. So I stood up. And I asked him one of the first questions. And let me look. Everybody's red mad.
Okay, hang on. Repeat what you just said. You asked the first question what?
I asked the question. Everybody in the audience got really angry at me.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
And the question was...
Dean, move somewhere else before you continue talking, because your cell phone's going out again.
Okay, I can't tell.
Isn't there a crime scene you can go
How's
to?
This?
That's fine. You always have sirens in the background. What neighborhood do you live in, dude?
I live in Brooklyn, and there's it's very like active down here, and this is a normal area of Brooklyn, by the way. Like this is like the most normal area of Brooklyn. So anyway, not crime ridden anything. It's just there's lots of old people around here.
So. What was your first? And they're all dying, obviously. What was your first question to him?
My question to him was, I saw a lot of references to a lot of 80s movies in this movie. And I'm going to read you a small – right now I'm going to read you a small list of the references, and I'm just going by memory right now.
Right.
But I saw Blue Velvet. I saw Ordinary People.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Evil Dead, Last Temptation of Christ, E.T., all sorts of – Peggy Sue Got Married, all sorts of references to 80s movies. And I asked, and this list was much longer than what I'm giving you now, okay? Like, I'm giving you only a truncated list right now. Anyway, I put this list out there, and he was flabbergasted by the question. And he said, I didn't realize I was really putting any of that in there. But that is bullshit. He knew exactly what he was putting in that movie, and he didn't want. He did not want to say it. He really knew what he was putting in there. You're gonna tell me that he didn't realize that Blue Velvet was in there from that first 5 minutes where Holmes Osborne sprays the water all over Maggie Gyllenhaal, and it's all in slow motion and everything.
Yeah.
Come on.
No, you bring up a good point, Dean. In my reviews for both, the reviews for Southland Tales and The Box, there's so much other films in there. So much visual winking, if you will, references to other films that makes sense with Donnie Darko. And it's not a bad thing. It's not like you're insulting.
No, it wasn't. I wasn't insulting
no,
him.
I realize. I know what you're saying. Because in that sense, he's like Tarantino in one way. He is. This is how he pays homage.
And he's actually better than Tarantino in a lot of ways because no one realizes it.
Nobody realizes it.
I would give him the benefit of the doubt and think that maybe he doesn't even realize it sometimes, Richard
Kelly. Well, maybe, and I didn't say, I didn't call him on it and say, hey, you're bullshitting me or whatever. I just sat down after he said he didn't know. I was like, all right. And, people were really angry with me because they took that as meaning that he stole the movie from all these different sources. I don't feel that at all. I know you didn't mean that.
It's with his films, you can't help. But when I watch Southland Tales, there's so much other films that I'm seeing in there that it's hard not to do that. No, but it's not insulting. I mean, that's what he does. He's very big into visual winking.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think that movie is genius because of what it does. I mean, the whole thing with Last Temptation of Christ, not only is Last Temptation of Christ up on the marquee at one point in the movie theater that they go to, but the whole ending of the movie is Last Temptation of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
The whole ending of the movie mirrors Last Temptation of Christ, which is probably one of the 10 great movies out of the decade. So
right.
It's like, and you're going to tell me that Donnie on his bicycle with his thing doesn't look like Elliot on his bicycle with E.T. and everything?
But that's a good point because in Southland Tales, on the Santa Monica Beach, on the Rock, wears the exact same thing that we're talking
exactly.
about. You know, E.T. is referenced throughout his work, so...
Yeah. I mean, he's a child of the 80s.
Yeah.
Or he's really a child of the 90s who grew up on 80s movies.
Right. Yeah,
and
I think it's a better description, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. He's really a child of the 90s who grew up on 80s movies. And I wasn't really trying to... I adore the movie, and I think it's a brilliant original piece that ranks up there with something like, I won't say that it's as great as this movie, which is my favorite movie of all time, but it's also Richard Kelly's favorite movie of all time, which is 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, he loved that movie.
I think that he was unconsciously also trying to go for a movie that didn't explain itself on first viewing, and even on second and third and fourth viewings, it didn't necessarily explain itself. And you have to go back and take a look at it again before you realize what's going on in it. I mean, I watched it 3 times in the space of a month.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I watched it twice on. Oh, and I was interested, Jamie, did you watch the director's cut or did you watch
no,
the original?
No, I watched the theatrical.
You watched the theatrical because that's the one to watch. I don't think the director's cut is as good. What do you think about that, Jerry?
Well, I think the director's cut, if I'm not mistaken, is just they took, when they released that, I think it was in 2003 or 2004, they just took the deleted scenes and inserted them.
Well, they did, but they also changed some of the music cues. Like, for instance,
that was always criminal. The music
the first music cue, which is that Echo of the Bunnymen.
Yeah,
song,
that's a great.
They changed that, and so those are the kind of things that I'm just like, director's cuts. 90% of the time, director's cuts don't work.
No, I agree with you there.
You know, I mean, I think there's always Blade Runners and THX 1138, but usually they don't work. I mean, usually they turn out like, Apocalypse Now Redux. So it's like, usually they don't work, and I think that the director's cut of Donnie Darko falls in that kind of category as well.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't an established enough director to do a director's cut anyway.
No, I think that was more the internet and the internet talking more than anything else.
Yes, exactly.
Joe Valley here in the chat room. He says, "I tell you what, I don't know what the hell Donnie Darko is about."
That's
a brave
the
man.
The hottest thing I've heard sometimes about that movie. At least he's honest about it.
Donnie Darko is about a boy that thinks he is a superhero and actually becomes one.
Yeah, no, but it's that. But wouldn't you also say when we get, let's take all that away from it. At the end of the day, you talk about 80s movies. And this is just a movie about teenagers.
It is. Eventually, it is a movie that's more realistic. It's almost like a more darker version, a Lynchian almost version of a John Hughes movie.
That's exactly. You're exactly right.
It is basically that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that he meant to do that. That's just how it came out.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of religious and scientific things going on in it. There's references to the abyss, you know, in the special effects with the,
yeah.
You know, I mean, there's all sorts of things in it that if you have the notion to think about it as a movie that's half about 80s movies, and half about religious and scientific and also personal matters, then you're going to really get it.
Yeah.
So the next time you call, you'll explain what Mulholland Drive is about?
Yeah, really. I mean, that's what I'm hoping for.
Mulholland Drive, yeah, well, yes, I could explain that very easily, very easily. By the way, one more thing.
Yeah, okay.
I think the next big movie star is going to be Tom Hardy, who was in Bronson.
Yeah, okay, Bronson. Yeah, that's the film I was thinking about.
And he's in Inception, and he's cast as Mad Max in the new Mad Max movie.
In the next two Mad Max movies.
In the next Mad Max movies, he is Mad Max. And I think Tom Hardy is the next big movie star.
Well, I think it's a good statement, and thank God he's Mad Max right now, because I don't know if I could stomach Mel Gibson as Mad Max. So.
No,
and he was also
very
good in Rock and Roller, the Guy Ritchie movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So,
that's where
I
know him from first. So,
but, I mean, Bronson was seriously one of the great performances of last year that didn't get any play whatsoever on the award.
I get ridiculed by our other caller, Roland, on this show for liking that. So,
Oh man, I don't think that Bronson is a great movie, because I think that it falls apart in its third.
Yeah, but it's got the use of classical music.
When he's free, oh yeah, it's got great music. It's actually kind of Kubrickian,
yeah,
and it's just some music.
Mm-hmm.
But and it even uses some music from other Kubrick from
yeah.
a Kubrick movie before, but probably Clockwork Orange. But the performance is the thing. Some movies are great because the movie is great. Some movies are great because the performances in it are great. Some movies are great because only one performance in it is great.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like. It's
but here's
like,
here's the question, Dean. Tom Hardy, he ever kill a man?
I don't know. We'll have to ask him that. You should get an interview with him and ask him. Yeah, hey Tom.
I think based on your criteria, I think that's the
don't
the main question.
That criteria is fair though. I mean, I don't think look, we haven't had a major war in really a little while. So
I think it transcends actually killing a man. I think it just speaks to the difference in generations, and then there have been no.
Okay, well, you know I'm just joking when I say killing a man, and here comes
so.
The...
That's where the ambulance is.
The ambulance. You know I'm just joking when I say a killing a man. What I mean is that they...
No, I don't.
They are, I mean, look, Lee Marvin really killed a guy, okay? I mean, many guys. But I'm saying guys who have been through an experience that made them men.
Right.
Nothing made Tom Cruise a man except aging 20 years. Nothing.
Well,
it's
the culture, man. In the past, you know, however many years, we've been redefining what is masculine.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I still look at Leonardo DiCaprio, and I'm sorry, I have a hard time accepting Leonardo DiCaprio as anything but an overgrown kid. And I really don't think he's done a great performance since he played a kid back with Catch Me If You Can.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go back farther than that to go to Gilbert Grape. I would say that those are the only two truly great performances that he has given. All the rest of them have been serviceable to the needs of the movie and everything like that, blah, 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 blah. And like, even with The Aviator, I'll give him the last half of The Aviator.
Okay.
He's done really anything great. All right. I'm going to leave you to that, and I'll look forward to hearing the interview.
All right, dude. Us too.
Yeah. Thank you, Dean.
Finally,
thank you so much, Dean.
Is it ready?
Thank you, Dean. Yeah,
right.
It's ready.
Yeah.
All right.
All right, man. Bye-bye. All right, that's the always opinionated Dean. All right, let's get to this interview.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah, man, definitely.
On October 12th, 1978, New York police discovered the lifeless body of 20-year-old Nancy Spungen slumped under the bathroom sink in a hotel room. Spungen, of course, was best known as the girlfriend of Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious, who was pronounced guilty before trial could even occur, partly because of the preconceptions concerning the nature of their relationship and their prolonged drug habits, and also because Vicious himself died of a heroin overdose less than 6 months later. Now, director Alan G. Parker, who's actually a punk rock enthusiast, he's written many books, several on Vicious himself, including a book called No One Is Innocent, which he based this film upon.
Mm-hmm.
He brings us the film called Who Killed Nancy, which is a stunningly effective crime story that dissects what actually occurred in the Chelsea hotel room the night of Nancy's murder. And this whole journey began, I think, in, I forget what year, but Sid's mother actually came to Mr. Parker and said, "You got to prove that my son is innocent, that he was many things but not a murderer." And so this has been a 24-year odyssey that concludes with this film. And we spoke to Alan, and Alan was at a very loud, noisy pub in London.
Okay.
So just keep that in mind as you're listening to the interview. But here he is talking about the film.
Him there, and on the bathroom floor they found the 20-year-old American girl he'd lived with for 2 years. Sid Vicious was arraigned today on charges of murder.
This is like right out of a Twilight Zone episode. You wake up, there's a knife, a pool of blood, and your girlfriend's in the bathroom, stabbed to death.
This guy's name was Vicious, supposedly violent. You know, of course he killed his girlfriend.
About 12 o'clock, Sid Vicious shot up some heroin. About 2 o'clock, he lay down to go to sleep.
Sid is no longer Vicious. He's dead.
Nobody ever followed up on it. It's like Sid got out, Sid OD'd, end of story. Is that really what happened?
There were so many people in the Chelsea in that room that night. None of these people seemed to have told anyone their story.
Detective Kilroy was one of the arresting officers when Sid was arrested. As far as he was concerned, Sid had guilty man written all over him. It was a smoking gun case.
People who had been at the party saw her flashing a lot of money around. No money was found in the room.
The last magazine interview the pair of them did, they were already telling people they'd got a suicide pact.
What would you like to happen now?
I'd like to have fun.
Are you having fun at the moment?
No, I'm not having fun at all.
Where would you like to be?
Under the ground.
The police all treated this like, who cares? Just another dead junkie.
He was a guy that never saw a red light. Everything was always green.
However dangerous.
However dangerous.
Who killed Nancy?
Nancy killed Nancy.
Fame killed Nancy Spongeon.
It was Rocket's red glare.
Obviously not she.
I think he did it in a moment of madness.
Oh my God, I know he didn't. She goes, that Michael guy was crazy.
This is the guy likely did it.
Sid was so stoned, he could not have lifted that knife, much less stabbed somebody with it.
And Beverly said to me, do me a favor and make sure that one day the world knows that whatever else my son was, he was not a murderer.
You, I understand, were into the punk music scene from a really early age, and I'm curious what the Sex Pistols and Sid Vicious in particular, how they spoke to you.
You know, man, the truth is this. I was into music from a very early age. I saw Slade play in 1973 with my father. I was 8 years old. I saw David Bowie when I was 9. Mark Bolan, T-Rex. His support band was the Damned. I remember we turned round to my father. We were in the balcony. And we said, who's the guy with the really weird nurse's outfit on? He said, I don't know. And it turned out, you know, years later, obviously, I found out it was Captain Sensible, Ray Burns. But, you know, that was kind of nice. I think, to be honest with you, the thing that got me about, the thing that made me want to be part of all that is, as I said to someone on a similar radio interview just last week, when I was a kid, you know, of course you wanted to be involved in music, you wanted to be involved in rock and roll, but you thought it was kind of an elite club. You thought that you almost had to be the son of John Lennon to be involved in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when punk came along, what happened was that we all suddenly realized that, you know what, you don't have to be the son of anybody. If you've got a good idea and you can prove you can pull it off, then you've won, you know. And that's what I think punk did for me personally, is it made me realize that Alan Parker was a commodity. You didn't have to be Julian Lennon. You didn't have to be James McCartney. You could be Alan Parker and still be a commodity.
Right. But you had actually, I mean, you were so taken by Sid Vicious and his story. You've written 3 books on him.
Yeah.
And I'm curious how your perception of him has matured over the course of those 3 books versus the perception that you might have had of him before you started investigating him.
Well, you know, man, let me just say this. When I first met Sid's family, and when I became involved in the whole Sid and Nancy thing, if anyone had told me that I would do 3 books, I would be involved in about 4 or 5 album deals for the family, I would do the Converse campaign deal just last year for the family, I would direct the film, you know, Who Killed Nancy, I would be involved in about 100 T-shirt deals and poster deals. I probably would have laughed in your face. But the reality is, you know, I came along, I was the fan, but also the family took to me quite quickly. Like, you know, Sid's mother and I got on very, very well. And I think the scenario is quite simply this. Once I got to know what the family were thinking, and what the reality was around their story, which to me was always very important anyway. I think, to be honest, I just wanted to kind of tell the truth. And I think that sometimes there's a whole lot of kind of notions, you know, whether it's Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, Kurt Cobain, Sid Vicious, anyone who died before their time, there's a lot of notions around it. But are we really hearing the truth? And that's what I... You know, that's really what I set out to do, certainly as regards when I wrote the last book and when I did the movie.
Yeah. And actually, his mother, I mean, she told you that she wanted you to show people the truth that her son could not have murdered Nancy. I mean, so it was kind of a mission for you at that point.
I think, to be honest, I just, you know, I've always been the kind of person who would look after those I trust and those I know, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we said right now, hypothetically speaking, that, you know, when this interview's over, you would turn around and say to me, you know, Alan, I'm really glad you said what you said, because I've got a cousin who did blah, 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 and I would say, well, what are we going to do about that cousin?
Yeah.
You know, what are we going to do to help him out? Why would we be, like, pulling away from him? We should be going towards him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Sid's mother said to me a long, long time ago, Alan, I don't think Sid did it. And the more kind of digging I did, and the more kind of time I spent looking for answers, I realized one thing, Sid didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I even had NYPD retired officers saying to me, Alan, Sid didn't do it. And I thought, you know what, this is really bizarre almost. That kind of, you know, it's like kind of weird in a way. But the truth is, he did not do it.
Mm.
And, you know, the more paperwork you see, and the deeper you dig, the more it becomes very easily obvious that he did not do it.
But you did all that groundwork for your book, and you were in a special position here, because you basically used your book as the groundwork for the structure of the documentary. Even so, was the idea and the process of making your first feature documentary film, was that a daunting task for you?
Well, Sid was not my first feature documentary. I started working as a researcher for a very well-known director, a guy called Don Letts, BAFTA winner, Emmy winner.
Yes, yes.
On a movie about a group called The Jam, which we did in England. You know, it was a very small budget thing, and it came out straight to DVD. And I knew Don very well, and I knew Don's then producer, a guy called Maureen Baker, very well. And we would talk away, and we would say, you know what, we should do this, we should do that. And we did quite a few things together. And then I started doing things on my own. And the first thing I did as a director was a film about the group Stiff Little Fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I moved on to a thing about the Pistols, which I did for BBC Three over here in England. And then a movie about The Clash, which I made for Sky One. So by the time my first cinematic thing came out, which was Who Killed Nancy, as you rightly say, I'd actually been involved in film and been doing things on that level for probably somewhere like 7 years.
Okay. But was it clear from the start that you wanted this not to necessarily be about the Sex Pistols and the history of the band and the music itself, but you wanted it to be a crime kind of thriller in a way?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is this. I could care less as regards the Pistols' history where Who Killed Nancy is concerned. You know, if anyone wants to know about the history of Sex Pistols, there's two fantastic movies out there already by, you know, the great Julian Temple, Phil from the Fury, and Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Mm-hmm.
And I could care less, really, what people think beyond that point, because that's the band's story and it's not mine. What I wanted to do was make a movie about the whole concept of whether or not Sid was guilty. And I was completely convinced that Sid was not guilty. And that's why we made Who Killed Nancy, you know? That Who Killed Nancy came about only through my own conviction.
Right. Tell me about the choice to do a film after you'd already written the book that the film is based upon.
Right.
The reasons for doing the film, were they because you thought they could reach a wider audience?
to be honest, I was getting to the point where I wanted to put a red line under my sort of association with Sid. I was at the point where I was kind of saying to myself, you know what, Alan? We've kind of done this. This is over, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of at the point where I was kind of going, you know what? I don't really want to be talking about Sid Vicious when I'm 55.
Right.
Now, I was 45 years of age just this year, in April just gone, and the film came out last year. And that's when I drew a kind of big fat red line under Sid Vicious in my world, because as far as I'm concerned, although I'm still really good friends with the remaining members of the family since Sid's mother passed away, you know, I've done what I can do. I can't do no more than I did, you know? And what I could do, I did already. So my thing is, you know, okay, we did it. Thanks very much, pump done, full stop. And I think with the three books, with the various things for the family, and then more importantly for Who Killed Nancy, we did what we said we'd do, and that's it done, you know.
When you screen the movie, what has the reaction been like? Any of the reactions surprising at all to you?
Well, the irony, really, if you're honest about this, you know. The movie has done so well in England, so well in Europe, amazingly well in Japan, you would not believe.
Hmm.
And it's now about to open in America, you know. Which in a way is quite ironic, because almost the whole of the movie set in America. You know?
Yeah.
Somewhere between Chelsea Hotel and Greenwich Village, Bank Street. That's the movie. You know, that's what we're talking about. So in a way for me now, it's been like, you know, kind of almost quite fundamentally strange, because, you know, you go, we did this movie and it opened all the way around the world, and then, but it didn't open in the country that we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the States, you know. The movie's set in the Chelsea Hotel and or Bank Street. And I look at it sometimes and I go, you know what, this is an American movie. This movie was made about America. So maybe now is good, because the time is that we're gonna do the movie in the one place it should have been shown.
I agree. And with you've been living with this for the past, what, 24 years?
Oh, a long time, 24, 25 years, yeah.
When you're so invested in the story and all the specifics of it, and you've lived with it for so long, and you're putting the film together, did you find it difficult to kind of back away and have perspective from an audience point of view to know if it's working or not?
Let me put it this way. Right this minute, while I'm talking to you, I'm sat outside a pretty popular pub in the West End of London with a good friend of mine who's one of the best drummers in London. I mean, you know, he's played with major bands, he's a session drummer, he's this, that, and the other. We're having a few beers, you know, we're kind of chatting away together. I think, to be honest with you, the whole thing about what we do and how we do it is this. I just want people to know the honesty about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if this means they can know it, then fine, fantastic. We didn't take anything out of Who Killed Nancy to make it more hard to understand. And we didn't take anything and put it in to make it any more complicated to understand. What we did, I think, is we gave people the chance to look at the story from every angle and make up their own mind, you know?
Yeah.
I remember when we did a kind of thing in Glasgow, and we were doing this thing at the Odeon Cinema, and they're going, you know, oh yeah, the Who Killed Nancy thing, blah, blah, blah. And one guy stood up after the thing was over, and was just a Q&A, basically, with myself, the director, and he said, Alan, he said, you know what? He said, I don't even want to ask you a question. I just want to say to you that now I believe Sid's innocent. And I said, you know what, man? That's brilliant of you. You know, never mind what you you know, I don't even know what you were going to say, but whatever you're going to say, that's nice.
Huh. He watched the movie and he was convinced that Sid did it from watching the movie?
He watched the movie, and by the end of it, he just went to me, Alan, I now believe Sid is innocent.
Innocent, okay, yes.
Isn't it? And I went, wow, fantastic. God love you, man, you know. Obviously, you watched it and you got it, you know. It's completely good.
Well,
I love that. That's fabulous.
It's pretty overwhelming from watching the movie. The odds are really against the possibility of Sid being able to do this.
Well, exactly.
Is there any hope of, I don't know, statute of limitations or anything? Is there any hope of this officially being reopened and reinvestigated?
We have sent a copy of the movie to NYPD. We've sent all the evidence we gathered to NYPD. The only thing I hope, and you know, I don't even know who I am in the scale of things, but the only thing I hope completely is this, is that one day people are going to take one look at this movie and say, Alan Parker was right, Sid's innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And if it happens to be the NYPD, then, you know, God love us, that's one step better nearer, you know?
Yeah. Well, it has to be, with how close you are to the family, you have to feel a kind of special responsibility with the work that you've done, concluding with this film, of correcting a lot of wrongs associated with Sid Vicious's legacy. So when you showed this movie for the first time to the family, what was their response to it?
Well, it was kind of in a way, to be honest. This may sound a wee bit too simplistic, but it was what I expected. It was like kind of, you know, I promised them I would prove a point. And I didn't, let me just say this, there was no way in this world I was ever going to sort of try to rewrite history to make Sid look innocent. If it turned out that my sort of deeper research proved that Sid was guilty, then either we would not have made Who Killed Nancy, or we would have been very honest. The reality is simply this. Everything we were doing pointed one finger in one direction, and that was that Sid was innocent. And, you know, when you start looking at some of the evidence, which obviously is all displayed there in the film, on screen, my favorite one, I love this. People always say to me, Alan, you must be telling a joke. It's true, you know. Sid and Nancy were in room 100 of the Chelsea Hotel in New York City for 3 months. And if you look at the, you know, kind of police report, they said, how many fingerprints from Sid did you find in room 100? They said 3.
Huh.
Now, you know and I know that between you and I tonight, there's more fingerprints on 2 telephones either end of the Atlantic than 3 each.
Right.
And we haven't been talking for an hour yet. And we're talking about 3 months. So, you know, I tend to go, you know what? We set off to prove a point. You know what? I think with the movie, we proved it.
You really did. And my eyes were open. I had no idea about the details of this case before I saw your movie. And it was really eye-opening for me. But there's also the aspect of, if Sid did not do it, who did?
Right.
And in your film, it points to a figure, like a mysterious figure named Michael. Do you think this guy is still out there somewhere? I mean, does your gut tell you that this was the guy that did it?
It's difficult to say, you know, because obviously we're talking about something that happened 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously, it's like the longer these things go on, the bigger the myth they gather. But I would just say this. One thing I'm confident about, and one thing I could, if you like, take to my grave with me, is when we finished editing Who Killed Nancy and we put it into cinemas, we told the truth. Now, obviously, it's up for a cinematic audience to make their own minds up. something, but I can't give them any more information than what I've got.
Yes.
And what I've got is what you see on screen.
Well, it's a fascinating movie, and I'm gonna urge every one of our listeners to check it out. What's coming up next for you? I know you just recently came out with a book, The Who by Numbers.
That's right. That comes out worldwide on Thursday this week, bizarrely enough.
Oh, wow. Good.
There's been many books written on The Who, but this is one of the few that Roger and Pete have been involved in. So we've had some nice reviews over here already. The next thing, cinema-wise, I just formed a new production company with some very, very nice people. But the nicest of all those people is my producer and also production partner, a lady called Alexa Morris. And the next film we're about to do is a film about a lady called Mary Millington, who was a porn star in England in the 1970s and committed suicide in 1979. But her story is nonetheless fascinating for all that. And so we were asked by a family to do it. We said yes, we would. And we've got some very, very big, you know, UK TV stars from the 70s who are going to be involved in it. And also we've got a family be involved in it. And so we're that's the next thing we're going to do. And but the main thing is this, is to keep us working, whether it be in London or it be in America, because I love the States and I spent so much time there. And all I say to people now is this, whether it's London, New York, or Los Angeles, as long as I'm working, I'm smiling.
Okay, that is director Alan G. Parker. The movie is Who Killed Nancy? It opens New York this weekend, I believe, on the 16th.
Dude, that was incredible. That was quite a wild interview.
Yeah. Big party going on in the background there.
Oh, it sounded like it.
yeah, it's an interesting, and to kind of demystify these rock legends in a way. That went far too soon.
Mm-hmm.
And I, when people think Sid Vicious, I mean, I'm sure the first or second thing they think of is Nancy. Because that's where the infamy comes in.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, interesting movie and an interesting director, Alan G. Parker. Hey, we got some upcoming shows. We welcome back Tana Frederick, a favorite actress of ours, on Wednesday night, I believe.
That should be great.
And then we cover a great new documentary called Hugh Hefner, Playboy Activist and Rebel, with that film's filmmaker, Bridget Berman. And then there's a great Kevin Kline movie called The Extra Man, and we bring on the directors of that film, who also directed American Splendor.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then we'll be celebrating Pauline Kael at the end of the month.
Cool. Very good.
All right. All right, guys. Sorry about the technical difficulties we incurred this evening. But we'll be back with you guys Sunday night. No, Wednesday night. It's Sunday night now.
Wednesday night we'll be back.
Yeah, Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Thank you, Jerry.
No, thank you. This is a lot of fun. Good way to end the weekend. Very good way to end. I can't wait till Wednesday night's show.
Let me see. What movie score should we do? I think I did one of yours last time.
Okay, do one of yours then. Let's do one of yours.
Do I have one?
Oh, God. Okay.
Gosh, they're just all so down, such downers to end the show with.
Well, we must have one that's good. I mean.
Oh, okay. Here you go. This is in honor of the most notorious celebrity of the week. All right. So we will see you guys on Wednesday night at 10.
All right. See you guys. Thank you.